Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
Joining us again today is Bill English from BibleAndBusiness.com. Bill and I are working our way through a number, actually a pretty large number, of lessons that we can learn from the life of David, actually prior to his becoming king. And so what are the leadership lessons that we can learn, and how can we apply them in our own lives? Bill is particularly interested in, focused on people who are business owners, but it does occur to me that every single one of us who is the head of a household of any kind or has the shared responsibility in a household to be like a home economist. By the way, a home economist means that you are in business, and the business is your home and your family, and you are the home economist, the person who is set with the responsibility to govern well, to operate well, to steward well what goes on inside your home. So we're going to talk today to business owners, and we're going to talk today to home economists about the lessons that we can learn from David. And we've arrived at chapter 17, which, Bill, might be the story that people think they know best about David's preparation to be king, and that is his defeat of the giant Goliath. So, first of all, welcome back.
Thank you.
Actually, I think you're kind of welcoming me back, because last week you continued in this conversation with our congregation.
With
the audience in my absence. And so could you remind
you,
us?
We missed you, by the way.
And yeah, we had coffee and donuts and after the service.
Of course you did. Yes. And there was fellowship.
Sitting on the couch that was so comfortable up there, too.
Yeah, these guys are okay. So,
off the rails,
Bill,
yes.
What did we miss? For those of us who were on vacation last week, what leadership lesson, if we could quickly just revisit it, what leadership lesson did we miss last week, and what is the leadership lesson this week? We're sort of like going to give it to people, and then we'll unpack it.
The leadership lesson this week is overcoming a seemingly insurmountable obstacle and the fear that goes with it. The leadership lesson last week was learning submission as a leader, that David had to go in and play the harp for Saul, for example. And I was kind of wondering about that on air. How do you do that as a guy that has already been anointed by Samuel to be king, and now you're having to go in and help Saul deal with the demonic that is oppressing him? And you're helping this guy, who really is now an illegitimate king, remain king and overcome some of the demons in his life. To me, that's a lesson in submission to authority. The idea was, you can't lead until you learn how to submit.
Mm. All right. So Bill and I are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to dive into the leadership lesson from the life of David this week, which is a message about overcoming. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. We'll be right back. We are in the 17th chapter of 1 Samuel. If you are wondering where in the Word Bill English and Carmen LaBurge are today on Mornings with Carmen, we are in the 17th chapter of 1 Samuel. Some of you will just immediately recall that is the chapter of the Bible where the Philistines are encamped on one hill, the Israelites on another. There's a valley between them. The champion, whose name is Goliath, a man from Gath, he was huge, 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet, a coat of scale armor that weighed 5,000 shekels. So this is a big man with big, heavy armor. He had his arms and his legs were covered. He had a bronze javelin slung across his back. What was notably not covered was his face. And David, you will recall, was like literally a shepherd. He was the eighth son of Jesse, and he was young. And so he had been anointed by the prophet, and he had been tending the sheep. And he comes to the battle to deliver snacks, really, like, right? And then he's like, why is everybody so terrified? That guy is, God's not on his side. God is on our side. And so that guy can be overcome. So, Bill English, why don't you pick up that ball and take it from there?
Yeah, and that is because of his training as a shepherd before he was even anointed, right? Because God helped him kill a lion, at least one that we know of, and one bear that we know of, right? It may have been multiple. And so even as a young teenager, on his own, by himself, he is killing predators that can easily kill men, right? You know, have you ever been to Yellowstone? I've been there. Have you ever been there?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, and they tell you don't go near the bears. And the reason for that is because the bears can kill you, right? David kills the lion and the bear, and I think those are probably more formidable predators against man than Goliath was against David, and I think David was the only one who saw that.
So when we think about the way that the enemy prowls around our life, Scripture uses that, you know, right? It's prowling around like a hungry lion looking to devour us.
Yep.
I do think that there are people who operate in fear much of the time, failing to be adequately prepared to take on what other people see as giants, and also failing to see the hugeness of God. So this is about perspective. Part of this is about perspective. So how is David's perspective just so radically different than the perspective of others around him at the time?
You know, this is speculation on my part because the scriptures don't actually say what I'm going to suggest, but I'm going to suggest that David relied on God and knew God would save him after he killed the lion and the bear. His perspective on God got a lot bigger, and God became bigger in his view of God. And so when we look around our lives, what is our actual view of God? Is God big enough to bring revival to America? For example, you know, John 16:32, ask me, this is the Bill English paraphrase now, ask me for anything in my name and I will do it, right? And is our faith in God, is God big enough to really accomplish that? And is our faith deep enough and strong enough to say, yeah, you know, we're going to ask for something that's very much in accordance with God's will, and we're just going to know that he's going to do it. We're just going to bank on that, right? And I just wonder how many of us have that kind of faith. And have we let God take us through those kinds of trials so that we have that kind of faith? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think that the question of whether or not my faith is actually in just in the God who is as big and great and extraordinary and unimaginable as the one who has revealed himself in the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments. Or is my faith in some smaller God? Have I reduced God in my thinking to something that I can manage or to something that I can fit into a slice of my life versus understanding that God is God and I am operating in his universe and I am operating, my next breath, the beat of my heart is completely and utterly dependent on God's sovereignty and his grace. And so is the day ahead of me, and so is my family, and so is my work. So when you talk to and think about business owners and people who operate in that in those spheres of influence, I'm wondering, Bill, if you've encountered people who see the giants in the world and in the workplace and don't recognize that those giants, which seem insurmountable, are also subject to the sovereignty of God if we would put our faith in him.
Yeah, you know, that is a great, great point. In fact, as you were writing, I was writing on a post-it note, and here, focus is greater than is more on danger. I think a lot of times when we don't have faith, it's not because we don't believe theologically that God is the ultimate, that God is great, that God is the Almighty. It's just that we're focused more on the danger, and we don't see the danger being under the sovereignty of God himself. And this is where, it's at least, Carmen, it's at least a couple dozen times in the scriptures where God is portrayed as either using evil for his purposes or being completely sovereign over evil in such a way that evangelicals kind of squirm a little bit, you know? And we talked about that last week, God sending the demonic forces on Saul in order to torment him, right? And evangelicals have a problem with that. But that's clearly what the Bible says. The danger is under the sovereignty of God. I would rather have a God that is completely sovereign over all of evil as well as all good, as opposed to having a God that just allows evil but is sovereign over good. To me, I would rather have the former than the latter.
Yeah, and I think that the contest in my own heart and mind is that sometimes it seems to me that God is out of control, and really what's going on is God is just out of my control. And instead, I need to get myself back in last week's lesson of submission, submit myself to the Lord my God, because he's going to give me his perspective on the giants of the day, and he is ultimately going to help me overcome them one way or another. So let's have the overcomer conversation when we come back. I'm talking to Bill English from BibleAndBusiness.com. He and I are talking about the leadership lessons that we can learn from the life of David. We'll be right back.
Deliver me. Deliver me.
Continuing my conversation with Bill English, you can find him at BibleAndBusiness.com, where you can also find the series of conversations that we're having on these leadership lessons we can learn from the life of David. We are today in 1 Samuel chapter 17. We're talking about Goliath. And before we move on to the reality of how God helps us to overcome and how Christ is the overcomer, Bill, I'm wondering if we can complete the part of the conversation about this constant thorn in the side, because the Philistines don't go away.
No, they don't. And that the Philistines, I think, are a picture of Satan in our lives. The Philistines are always going after the Israelites. They are always tempting them to worship other gods. They're always coming after them militarily and presenting a real constant over many decades, really a thorn in their side. It's almost like Paul. Remember, Paul in the New Testament said, God has given me this thorn in the flesh, this messenger of Satan. Again, God's sovereignty over evil. This messenger of Satan to hone me and what he calls buffet me, to refine me. Seems to me that is a picture of how Satan is with us and how evil is with us as we try to follow God. It's a constant thorn in our side. Doesn't have to overcome us, though.
And I think that when we think about Paul certainly asked, and he tells us, he asked three times for that thorn to be removed, and God did not remove it. And so I always find it encouraging to know that, because if God was going to do it for anybody, he would have done it for Paul. Like, right?
Well, that's the assumption.
Such a man of great faith, right? So obviously God had a purpose for not taking the thorn away, for not alleviating whatever it was that the enemy was using to sort of gnaw constantly at Paul. And so when there is something that is persistent in my life, when there is something that that won't go away, if I can get God's perspective on it, if I can recognize that, yes, this is the enemy, this is uncomfortable, it is nagging, but it is not outside of God's sovereignty. So talk with us about this overcoming, because not only does David defeat Goliath, but it is a heroic act of overcoming.
It is. But I got to ask the question, and this is a really tricky question. Does God have a purpose in bringing evil into our lives? And I know that some listening to me right now are going to be very upset as to how I phrase that, right? But I have such a strong view of God's sovereignty that God bringing evil into my life doesn't mean that God is doing evil and the evil doesn't touch him, but he still is allowing it to come into my life. Can God have a purpose for that? In other words, can God use evil to grow my faith in him? I think when you look at David and Goliath, Goliath is a picture of evil. He is a persona of evil. And God has grown David's faith in him being God, through the lion and the bear. And now David goes out, and he's the only one, mind you, he's the only Israelite that thinks he can win. Everybody on the hill who are Israelites, they all think he's going to get massacred, right? This young guy's just going to get slaughtered. And he's the only one that goes out there. And the reason that he can overcome is because he has allowed himself to be brought along in this journey of faith by God, who brings evil into a life in order so that you can learn about the almightiness and the goodness of God.
So we have a listener who wants to remind us the story of Job in the context of this conversation. So, yeah, I think that, you know, there is certainly biblical evidence of the way in which God allows evil to operate and influence us. And God is, you know, frankly, looking for us to have faith in his faithfulness. And that doesn't mean that every day is going to be sunshine, right? I mean, it just doesn't. And so again, let's just turn our attention to business owners, but also, you know, we're recognizing that everybody who's listening right now is operating in the business of their own life, even if they're not operating as an entrepreneur in a particular business. So when we're talking to people who are facing problems today that seem insurmountable, they're facing fear. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're not even sleeping well because of it. They don't see a way out of the mess. What is God's counsel to them from this lesson from the life of David?
Well, let me get to the life of David in a minute. The where I start with the counsel in those situations is James 1:2. Consider it pure joy whenever you face trials of many kinds, right? Because you know that the testing of your faith, whatever the trial is, whatever the difficulty is, whatever the insurmountable object is, it is a testing of your faith. And that faith will produce perseverance, and the perseverance, when it's finished, you'll have a maturity on the other side of that trial that you did not have before the trial came. And so when you go back and you look at the life of David, it seems to me that there are two things to look at as a Christian business owner and B, as just a regular person. And one of them is, as you face this insurmountable problem, if you're waking up with waves of fear and terror at night, if you don't see a way out of this mess, if you don't know how you're going to get through it, that is the time to quiet yourself and turn to the Lord and let him speak into your heart and let him renew your mind and learn to rely on him, because this is really about your faith. It's not about the problem that is in front of you.
Yeah, it's about the faithfulness of God to ultimately overcome.
It is.
So this whole conversation starts with the Philistines imagining and believing that they, because of their physical prowess, are going to be able to wipe the people off the face of the earth. And that's what we would call an existential threat, like the threat to their very existence as a people.
Yes.
Israel continues to face an existential threat today. I mean, we hear in the headline news about Iran, and Iran views it as its, you know, one of its reasons for being is to wipe Israel off the map, to push those people into the sea, to, you know, to get rid of Israel. This existential threat to the Jews has existed for a really long time. This is a persistent thorn.
Yes.
And yet we recognize that we're not going to operate constantly out of fear of those who would seek to do us harm or do us ill. Instead, we are going to press forward positively as those whom God has redeemed and called and equipped to move forward in faith in his faithfulness, regardless of what happens to me as an individual. Does that kind of wrap it up?
It does. It's a verse I don't like, but do not fear the one who can kill the body, only fear the one who can kill the body and the soul.
Yeah, amen. Amen. Bill English from BibleandBusiness.com. You guys can go to BibleandBusiness.com and grab these leadership lessons from the life of King David. Bill, as always, thank you. We look forward to the next portion of this feast next week.
You bet. I look forward to it as well.
We'll be right back. So John Stone Street, whom you just heard, president of the Colson Center on Worldview and host of Breakpoint, heard every day right here, is the author of several books. He's back today to talk about his newest book, Life, Marriage, and Religious Liberty. That's next. So you still got a couple of days to register for and get to the Northwestern Christian Writers Conference. It is actually happening this Friday and Saturday, July 12th and 13th, at the University of Northwestern St. Paul. Great keynote speakers, including Gary Thomas on Friday night, Robin Jones Gunn on Saturday. But there's also opportunities for you to meet with industry representatives and faculty members to get to know people in the publishing industry and also hone your craft as a writer. So you get to interact with successful authors and acquisition editors and literary agents. We just want to invite you to jump in. It's not too late to join us at the Northwestern Christian Writers Conference, and that's also the website, northwesternchristianwritersconference.com.
Today's moms and dads are so worried about being friends with their kids, they've forgotten how to be parents. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. I've seen parents get so lax with their kids that they look more like buddies than parents. I like to call them parents. But in my experience, their children grow up to be selfish, demanding, and aggressively controlling adults. Good luck finding friends then. So how can we be parents, not parents? Being a parent means you're willing to exert some authority. You still know how to have fun, but you're not afraid to put your foot down when needed. Because if you won't fill that parental role, your kid will look for a role model elsewhere. Your teen has plenty of friends. They don't need any more mom and dad. Be a parent.
Want more help from Mark Gregston? Find books and other resources online at parentingtodaysteens.org.
Hey, welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. Joining me today is John Stone Street. You know him as the voice of Breakpoint and The Point, which you hear every day here on Mornings with Carmen. He is the co-editor of a new book, Life, Marriage, and Religious Liberty, with David Dockery, whom you also recognize as the president of Trinity International University. And John heads up the Colson Center. I mean, John, we love the Wilberforce weekend. Many of us have just watched the streaming of that over the weekend. Thank you for all that you do. Let's talk specifically about this book today, okay?
Well, thanks, Carmen. It's great to be on with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Okay, so this book, which is Life, Marriage, and Religious Liberty, which is What Belongs to God, What Belongs to Caesar, is really a bit of a look back at the Manhattan Declaration, which was authored and signed 10 years ago. And so I'd love to talk about that document. And then I'd love for us to talk about what those subject matter areas are today in the conversation that Christians are having with the culture.
Yeah, in a sense, it is a look back, but not in a look back in terms of any sort of memorial. It's just what Chuck Colson and Robbie George and Timothy George put together in this document, which is called the Manhattan Declaration, which 500,000 American Christian signed, was really a statement of Christian conviction that no matter where the culture moved on three fundamental issues, life, marriage, and religious liberty, Christian conviction was clear. And you know, it was basically recognizing that on those three issues, and that we were going to come into a place of great conflict with the culture and even with the state. In fact, the very last line of the document, I think, is the most important. It says that we will ungrudgingly render to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, but we can never render to Caesar what belongs to God. And when you talk about, what the definition of marriage is, that's not something the state decides. That's not something the church decides. That's something that God decided in the way that he made the world. And when you talk about what the value of life is, that's not something that we can, change, even if we're legislators high-fiving in New York. It's something that actually is determined by God. And then our conscience ultimately belongs to God. We answer to someone higher than the state. And that's actually something that America has recognized since its founding, but increasingly was putting the clamps on. So it was a very prophetic document. And those issues, 10 years later, are not less important. They're as or more important than ever.
And when I think about the movement on these issues in the culture in that 10-year period of time, so if we look back to 2009, we did not have same-sex marriage as something that was recognized by the Supreme Court across the country. That happened with the Obergefell decision at the Supreme Court in 2015. And so I just think that when we look at the pace of change, even just on that one issue, the culture is clearly moving. I'm wondering, John, how you feel like this book equips Christians today to both be informed on, but then equipped for conversations in these areas on life, marriage, and religious liberty.
Well, every chapter in the book is aimed at today. It's basically saying, look, the convictions that were outlined in the Manhattan Declaration haven't changed. So what does it look like today? Because you're exactly right. 10 years later, you can really see that Caesar's grasp has, extended. The issue of life is probably the only one of those three where, back in 2009, Caesar had, laid claim on it in America through the Roe v. Wade decision. And even in 2009, the thought that Roe might be up for grabs, might be back in play, would have been unthinkable. And now, 10 years later, we've seen, states kind of go to their extreme corners. And this is still very much a live, volatile issue. But the issue of marriage, the issue of conscience, what we're going to be forced to do by the state in terms of violating our convictions, these things, back in 2009, basically, those guys saw this thing coming, but it wasn't here yet. It was before the Obergefell decision. Even with abortion, we didn't have the state saying, you had to participate. We had a couple cases, since 1972 of hospitals, making nurses, perform abortions or participate in abortions, and the Supreme Court had largely protected them. Now, of course, we've got the Jack Phillips and the Baronelle Sussman cases and so many others. When it comes to the issue of marriage. And so each of the chapters of the book, and we got basically five chapters on life, five chapters on marriage, five chapters on religious liberty, look at, why are these matters of Christian conviction now, just like they were 10 years ago? What are the challenges now? And what's it going to look like to articulate Christian faithfulness in this cultural moment? And it's really an all-star cast of contributors. I mean, we were blessed to have so many people that were involved in the original Manhattan Declaration, as well as so many new folks who provide thought leadership in those areas.
Yeah, there's no question. The list of contributors is long, and many of our listeners would recognize people who we've had on, to talk about those subject matter areas in their own right. John, I think that one of the things people need to know about the book is what I perceive you are seeking to do is actually teach people the principles. It's not just that there was an answer to this question on this day in this courtroom. It is that these are the answers to these questions in every conversation and before the judgment of the world.
It is, yeah. In other words, how do you articulate the Christian conviction on these issues? And then also, what's going to be required of us going forward? And really, we've got, I think two angles on that. One is, in a cultural moment in which Caesar is laying claim on those three areas, Christian faithfulness is going to cost us something. And this isn't anything new for our brothers and sisters throughout history. It's not anything new for our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world. But we haven't always found ourselves, at least in the American context, having to choose, you know, for example, at some time between our faith and our livelihood, between our career and our convictions. But increasingly, that's being asked of us. And I don't think that's going away. I think this is kind of the new normal. And second, that our culture has moved so far, particularly, I think, on the issue of marriage, that to articulate a Christian position on marriage not only will cost you something, but it's kind of like talking a foreign language. And so being able to articulate the fundamental connection between the way that we're made as male and female and this institution of marriage and how that plays into the good of society, you know, that's what these chapters prepare us to do, is to both live out of a sense of conviction and articulate what that conviction is in a culture that's, you know, hostile in many ways to Christian conviction on these areas.
Hey, friends, I got to take a quick break. When we come back, more with John Stone Street on life, marriage, and religious liberty. Continuing our conversation now with John Stone Street on life, marriage, and religious liberty. It's a brand new book, What Belongs to God, What Belongs to Caesar. His co-editor is David Dockery, whom you will also recognize. John, again, thank you so much for being here, and thank you for the book. I'm wondering, as we think through these issues, life, marriage, and religious liberty, I'm wondering if you are wishing, as I am a little bit, that 10 years ago, we had seen the identity conversation, the conversation specifically about transgenderism, and we had begun to address that in the same context of this conversation.
Well, the identity conversation is, you know, is part of the life issue, and it's part of the marriage issue. And if you go back to the original text of the Manhattan Declaration, it does deal, I think, with the issue of identity. But what it never got to was transgenderism. And that's a very interesting kind of social dynamic. If there weren't such serious consequences for it, it would be kind of interesting to look at. But it is unbelievable that 10 years ago, the idea that we needed to articulate Christian conviction on what is male, what is female, was really unheard of. It just wasn't part of the conversation, other than in the issue of homosexuality and same-sex marriage. But the idea that we would, for example, be facing the challenge of women's sports kind of being completely compromised by men running in women's races and so on. We saw that, by the way, just over the weekend in the NCAA indoor or outdoor championships. You know, it's just really an amazing indication of how quickly things have shifted. And it's also, I think, kind of an amazing indication of why Christians need to care about ideas. We say around the Colson Center that ideas have consequences and bad ideas have victims. And ideas spread really quickly. You know, basically, when an idea makes something thinkable, like, for example, that there is no such thing as fundamentally as male-female, that our biological sex is disconnected from our gender and so on, then that kind of – basically, once the Pandora's box is open, the rabbit hole continues to go. And that's what we've seen with the transgender issue. And, yeah, I mean, we need to have that conversation more, and this is what the chapters in the book do. When it comes to the issue of life and marriage and religious liberty, these aren't just moral issues. These are fundamental cosmological issues. And what I mean by that is they reflect the deepest understanding of how Christians make sense of the world and how that understanding currently is in conflict with the way the larger culture sees the world. And there's no way around that. There's only a way through it, and it requires Christian conviction and clarity.
So, John, one of the things that I appreciate about what you do every day on The Point and Breakpoint and what you do in this book is that you are helping us not only understand that we have a worldview and understand what that worldview is and how it is defined over and against other worldviews, but you actually help us help other people see their own worldview because we give them something to see it against. And so I genuinely appreciate that because I don't know that everyone who is engaged in apologetics today is approaching it in that way, that our goal is really to help other people see the lens that they're seeing things through and recognize how that is different and distinct from the way we are seeing things.
in order that we might have a conversation with them about the difference.
Well, I hope that's the case. And I hope that's the case even on these three issues of the book, which is, I mean, these are contentious issues. There's no question about it. I mean, we're increasingly seeing state by state really double down on wherever these lawmakers think their abortion law should go. And certainly the issue of marriage, it's one thing, you know, to be considered wrong about, you know, the fact that marriage is between a man and a woman. Increasingly in our culture, if you say that, you're considered evil, right? And then that plays into our ability to live out those convictions in the public square. But we don't articulate Christian conviction on these areas to say, oh, we're right and you're wrong. We do it because this is true and ideas have consequences. And that's really what we want people to understand, is that increasingly in our culture, speaking the truth is seen as an act that's inherently unloving. And yet truth and love go hand in hand. Truth and love find themselves grounded in the person of Jesus Christ. We're commanded to hold those two things together. Jesus said the greatest commandment was to love him, and the second commandment is to love others. And to love God has a lot to do with truth, and to love others has a lot to do with speaking the truth. And increasingly in our culture, you're not supposed to be able to do that. Well, Christians don't have that option because we obey, again, God, not Caesar. And we're going to have to figure out how to do it, even if it comes at personal cost, and to do it in such a way that we're not just a jerk, right? And we don't need to be a jerk to articulate Christian conviction. Christianity fundamentally is true with a capital T. And so fundamentally, it's a loving thing to say. We got to figure out how to do it. It's hard. I mean, it is hard, isn't it, Carmen? You guys talk about this every day, and it's a really hard thing to do. But listen, to follow Jesus has public implications, and we can't skirt those implications, even if we don't like and we feel uncomfortable with them.
Well, that's exactly right. So, friends, the book is What Belongs to God, What Belongs to Caesar, Life, Marriage, Religious Liberty. The co-editors are David Dockery and John Stonestreet. You hear John here every single day during this program. He offers us The Point. He offers us Breakpoint. He is also the president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, and you can check out everything that he is doing there as well. Hey, John, what's like the one-stop shopping to track you down?
Breakpoint.org, breakpoint.org. From there, you can subscribe to our podcast. You can sign up for our email list. You can find the book. That's really the one-stop place to find us.
I love it. Breakpoint.org. John Stonestreet, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thanks, Carmen.
We'll be right back. So in case you imagine that John Stonestreet and I and others who are concerned about the Christian, biblical, or gospel worldview are overstating things, and that we are seeing challenges in the culture where challenges don't exist, I just want to lift up to you one little interesting piece of news today, and that is that the American Psychological Association. So we're here talking about the Association of American Psychologists, right? So people who are counseling other people. They have established a task force on, quote, consensual non-monogamy. Now, consensual non-monogamy is something called polyamory. It means multiple love partners. And so polyamorous relationships or consensual non-monogamy is now apparently in need of advocacy by psychologists. So the American Psychological Association is seeking to destigmatize, reduce the stigma on persons who practice polyamory through the efforts of this task force on consensual non-monogamy. So today, as you walk your faith out there into the world that God so loves, I want you to do so redeeming what love is. Be a redeemer of love. Be a redeemer of truth. Be a redeemer of grace. That is your role and responsibility as an ambassador of the King and the Kingdom. Be a truth teller. Always do so with grace. And let's be praying for each other. So I am going to spend the next few minutes actively praying for you, and I would invite you to do the same for me. So pray for me that I would continue to glorify God and edify his people. And you go forward and have a great day. And God bless.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.